Our talk tonight is going to be given by Dharma holder Kate Hartland. And this is a very propitious occasion, this Dharma talk. It precedes a ceremony that's going to happen later on in the night, a private, what we call a secret ceremony, where Kate will receive the second part of Dharma transmission from Josh, making her a sensei, a fully transmitted teacher. And the Leadership Council of Boundless Way has already voted her in as a guiding teacher. So this is Kate's last talk as a Dharma holder.
So don't blow it.
And I'm looking forward to it.
I thought I would be consistent with the past ones and go ahead and blow it. So we're reading from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and I dug out my old copy and was surprised to find that, although it's not as old as Alan Richardson's, I understand his was from the first edition, mine did cost $2.95 and is from 1975. And I guess it says something about the book, the time, the teacher, how much Alan and I, and many other people, I'm sure, valued it to carry it down through all those years. I've moved many times. I've purged my books many times, but this one has always made the cut. So I was really pleased to hear that we were going to be speaking from it. So now we're in the third part of it, right understanding. And I chose the one that's labeled as Believing in Nothing. And the little blurb at the top is the quote that I want to look at. It says, "In our everyday life, our thinking is 99% self-centered. Why do I have suffering? Why do I have trouble?" Well, I think Suzuki Roshi came down a bit hard on us there, speaking about our self-centered thinking. Maybe we come down hard on ourselves, feeling that we should not have self-centered thinking. But there it is. I don't know about you, but for me, this is often the case. He's quite accurate. And so I was thinking about this matter of why we have suffering, why we have trouble. And it put me in mind of a book that I got from my daughter for Christmas. I had come upon a review of this book and was intrigued by it. And I took a look at it on Amazon.com, you know, where you can look inside and read a chapter or two. And as I was reading through it, I realized that it was what I thought was quite relevant for my daughter in her line of work, and so I thought I would get it for her for Christmas. And double bonus points, before I gave it to her, I could read it. So I did, and the book is called Dear Sugar. It comes from it's a compilation of I guess it was a message board or something like that, advice column. People could write into Sugar and then she would answer them. And it's rather different than most advice columns, at least the ones that I've read before, in that she doesn't really dole out advice. She has this wonderful way of listening to what the person is writing, and then sort of resonating with that in some way from her own life and sharing that. And out of that sort of shared experience, something comes up that's not necessarily an answer, but maybe a pointer. So as I read through it, I came to one that particularly struck me. It seemed to be the very distillation of all the questions in the book down to just this one letter. I'll read it to you. Dear Sugar, I'll just wait one moment. And so, the letter. Dear Sugar, WTF, WTF? WTF? I ask this as it relates to everything all the time. If there are any people listening who for whom English is not your first language, and perhaps you're not familiar with this term, WTF, I'll translate it for you, or I'll unpack it. What the fuck? Which actually, if you think about it, doesn't mean anything in and of itself, right? I mean, if you put that into a translator for your own language, it would come out rather nonsensically. And so it's sort of a pure presentation of perplexed or puzzled outrage. Put those two together. And so this person is asking, you know, how did things get to be like this? It should not be this way. Something is wrong here. In fact, in their case, everything is wrong all the time. I thought that might be appropriate to look at tonight. For perhaps slightly over half the population of our country, we have been asking this since November. And for slightly under half the population of our country, we may have been asking this well before November. So everyone is familiar with it. It's our big national outcry. WTF. And although Suzuki Roshi suggests that it's rather self-centered to ask this, nevertheless, it comes forward. And I think there's something of... I want to honor the integrity of really speaking how we feel, regardless of whether it might be pointed to as self-centered or inappropriate or whatever. It is what we feel. And so to bring that forward is the important thing, to have a look at it. So thinking of this question... and this sort of perplexed outrage also reminded me of something that happened when my children were little. It happened not infrequently, actually. I'm going to say that my son Noah was maybe six, and that would put my daughter, Alex, who received this book, at about three. We used to like to play games together. I'd get down on the floor with them, and we'd build like villages out of blocks, and get out the farm set and put the farmer out there and his cows and the tractor and have cars and trucks. And there was like a whole village and a community, and we would act out their lives while playing with them. Not infrequently, my son would get kind of tired of the status quo of this village, and he would decide to mix it up a bit and perhaps have the cow fly. And it might fly up into a tree, and then I might respond by having the farmer bring a ladder over and climb up into the tree and check out the cow nest to see if there were any eggs that we could harvest, and so forth. Things would just go... evolve in unexpected directions. And at some point, my daughter, the three-year-old, would become so disgusted and outraged by this that she would stomp her little foot and shake her fist and say, "You're not playing by the rules." And, here she was at three trying to figure out what the rules were. You know, she didn't have it solid enough yet that she could toss them out and begin to expand out from there. And I think that often we find ourselves in that position. What are the rules? It's not supposed to be like this. Cows don't fly. Wrong people don't get elected, whichever one you think was wrong, the one before or the one now. And one of the things that our practice does for us, helps us with, being able to be flexible with the rules, because we don't really know what they are. I think this has come up several times in past talks about, you know, where's the guidebook? Where's the rule book for this human life? There isn't one. We don't know what the rules are. And no sooner do we have some inkling of what they might be and we go full forward with that, then we realize that, no, that's not quite it. It feels as though it's an ever-shifting field. But really, it's just that our rules haven't quite captured it. There's a further line that really struck me in this section from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Just one sentence where he says, "You strive for a perfect faith in order to save yourself." Seems so true that these are our secret practices, that somehow if we try hard enough, if we practice hard enough, we can save ourselves from whatever calamity we imagine may come up, perhaps from the ultimate calamity of our own perishing, I don't know. But that there's always a deal being made. If I practice very hard, maybe then I'll understand what the rules are. I'll be able to see so clearly that I'll know what to do in a given situation. I'll be able to respond in a way that's helpful, that I can straighten out this mess. And I'm sorry to say that I don't think that's what's on order. Saving ourselves is not what it's about. And so we're left with this cry, WTF? This honest coming forth from where we are. So as I was pondering this last night, thinking what I might say, and sort of browsing through this and that, sort of unrelated things, really, I came upon a poem that really struck me as to the point. It was written by a poet, obviously, who would find himself at poetry readings where often as not there were people who in the audience who did not like poetry. Perhaps they'd been dragged along by a spouse, or they were, you know, trying to get some culture or whatever. But he recognized that this often occurred. And so he wrote a poem for them. And it is this. "I, too, dislike it. Reading it, however, with a perfect contempt for it, one discovers in it, after all, a place for the genuine." And I thought how true that was for us as well, in our certainty that things should not be this way. Something's wrong here. This is not what we bargained for. "I too dislike it, and feeling it, however, with a perfect contempt for it, one discovers in it, after all, a place for the genuine." This is a place to enter in, this dislike. And I read a bit more about this poet and his writing of the poem, and he said it became that the first line of it, "I too dislike it," became a sort of a mantric prayer for him. He found himself repeating that line over and over to himself. "I too dislike it. I too dislike it." He said it was the closest he had ever come to ceaseless prayer. This really resonated with me. I have found myself in such situations as well, where I was so utterly stymied, where I did not know where to turn or what to do next. All I could do was throw up my hands in surrender and say, please help. That was one way that it came forth one time. Another time was just repeating the three refuges over and over and over. There was nothing else but that. And it's curious that in doing this, in entering in our sense of outrage and our absolute obstinance about the insistence on the wrongness of the way things are, when it is distilled down to this this one expression, whatever it is for us, and there's a way that it gathers up all the energy of that protest and begins to have its own life and begins to reveal it, a way forward. Maybe not, but then again, maybe. So, no need to meet our outrage, our objections, our protests by thinking that we should not have them, by thinking that because they are self-centered, as Suzuki Roshi said, that they are somehow wrong. Instead, this is the place where we enter. It is where we meet what is true for us in that moment, but to meet it with a willingness to recognize that we may not know the rules, that maybe they are some other way, and to be willing to let go of our insistence that we know how things should be, long enough to wonder if maybe the way that they are turning out to be might be a different sort of okay. We don't know. But this may be a path forward. I too dislike it. It shouldn't be this way. WTF! I too dislike it. I too dislike it. I too dislike it.
So please make yourselves comfortable and we'll have our Dharma dialogue.
Kate, as you were talking, I couldn't help thinking about the Psalms in the Bible, how many of the Psalms are exactly this kind of lament. You know, my God, why have you forsaken me? WTF. You know, clear presentation of this human, why is it like this? And the genuineness of it, and the beauty, the aliveness. It's a great tradition.
Right, I'm just thinking the same thing. It's a tradition.
Yeah.
What was the name of the poet?
I'd have to go and look. Oh, I didn't write it down. Okay.
I too dislike it. That's recently, as some of you know, because we chanted for her, my grandmother died. Liz and I went to tell my mom in her nursing home this news. And my mom has fairly advanced Parkinson's disease and also some substantial psychologically related stuff as well. And when we told her this news, she responded with wanting to have a new computer, wanting us to take her for a ride in the car, wanting this. And it was, you know, initially very kind of frustrating and painful and off-putting for me and Liz, but essentially we were able to change our experience of that by hearing her saying, "I want it to be different than it is." Mm-hmm. And then we could respond, "I too dislike it."
Christine.
Thank you very much. What comes up for me in this time a great deal is the role model of Nelson Mandela and Thich Nhat Hanh, each different, but Nelson Mandela started out with a tremendous outrage and the bombing and his transformation over time, and reading his book, The Long Walk to Freedom, how over time he was able to see the places of the sameness. And then I think of Thich Nhat Hanh's poem, "I am the woman who was raped and I'm the pirate that raped her." Now, I am nowhere there, and I always thought that that sounded so wonderful until we got into this situation, and I'm really wrestling with myself in all of this. And I do take refuge in Thich Nhat Hanh the way he found refuge in the Sangha, the Dharma, and the Buddha, as sort of a navigation place at this time to work through my own what the fuck.
I have my own challenges with vacillating between wanting to call someone out for what has been said or done and wanting to find that common ground. I guess both are needed. I'm not particularly skillful in figuring out which when to use which.
Mine's
like...
Yeah.
And, Kate, part of what I hear you saying is that this outrage is the Dharma appearing, mm-hmm. not that. So this teaching that whatever appears, if we meet it and if we don't judge it, oh, I shouldn't be feeling this, so let me try to work on through this. But in the full allowing of this and being with this, mm-hmm. that you're suggesting that it might lead somewhere surprising.
Yes. Of course, in the meantime, I'm brushing up against people. You know, maybe it hasn't led to that surprising place.
Yeah.
So I might surprise other people. I can say that has indeed borne out in experience. But what can you do but take the step forward from where you are? And keep looking at it.
Well, and I hear you say take the step into it.
Yes, right, into it.
Step into it, and that there is some treasure here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Not that you go into it so it will go away,
right.
But...
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes, thanks for clarifying. Yes.
Sorry, go ahead.
One of my friends put up a wonderful video this morning. This woman was talking in front of a congregation of mixed people and mixed religion people. Because that could have gone anywhere. But she talked about her grandfather, who was detained before he came in here because of his skin color and his turban, and how somebody, a lawyer, came and saved him from that, and that inspired her to become a lawyer later. And how, when she became a mother, she was trying to save the magical moments of, like, Santa Claus for a child by becoming part of the illusion. But in the end, she said, "I learned more from being a mother that this time might not be the tomb that we see it, but perhaps the womb where we have to breathe, but then we got to push because we'll die if we don't." Mm. So it's breathing and pushing. And I thought, oh, that's so very Zen. And that reminded, what you were saying, reminded me of that.
Yeah, and I guess that it's always both the tomb and the womb, right? Something dying, something being born out of that.
Yeah. Clara?
I too dislike it. I can't stop repeating it in my head. And in a way that gives a tremendous amount of hope, actually, for me, and space. The amount of space that comes from approaching something with in that way. Because I think I too dislike it. We don't have to enumerate the reasons why. We don't have to go into an explanation. It just lets it be that. There it is, you know. And I think that it's not just one group of people that could be saying, I too dislike it. The poet itself is saying it. Mm-hmm. So it, you know, it kind of goes beyond the like or dislike. It unifies in some way. Mm-hmm. That we can come together not based on what our choices are, but that feeling is there, that it's kind of all-encompassing, and in that is a connection, not a disconnection.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate it, and I think it will be going through my head for a while.
What do you take from the Zen retreat?
Yes. How to
but it is the first noble truth.
That's right.
Yes.
An exploration of suffering. Yeah, it's above.
And I think what, you know, tonight, the I too dislike it, really letting us give voice to that, is like exactly what we need to do. Life is suffering, and if we think about it, we have precepts, we have commitments that we don't have to doubt. We have commitments that form another pillar. We can rage and say, I too dislike it, and that energy can be transformed, but the commitments are always there. They don't go away. They're the North Star. Mm-hmm. They guide us through all the WTF that we want to scream at the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sort of want to combine this morning with this evening, mm-hmm. with your talk this evening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, we're not rudderless. Right?
Yeah, we're not rudderless, exactly.
And I think there's something too, you know, personally, we're talking globally, politically, and I heard in your talk this very personal, you know, the dear sugar, this woman right at me again, what the fuck. It starts out, you know, we're sitting on the cushion here, and aversion arises, right? And how many people haven't had aversion arise today? And I'm not just talking about the inauguration. I mean, it just could be about anything. You know, somebody next to you just not sitting still, or somebody's in the bathroom, or when you have to go, and you know, there's so much, and you could sit and rationalize all that. But what we're advocating, what I heard you advocating, is this embrace of aversion as normal human,
right.
Human tendency, and that in that itself, and I think this has been our theme recently, is everything we need. You know, that we're often aversive to something because we have an idea about something else should be happening.
Mm-hmm.
And that's our care and our love. You know, we want something else to be happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get to just hold all that together, and it blends into something surprising, new.
Right.
That leads us forward.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen so many people feel aversion arise and go, oh, I'm a meditator, so I shouldn't feel this, and let me think about what I should do. Oh, I'll practice loving kindness now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this is almost the polar opposite of that.
Right, and allowing the aversion to exist for however long it exists, like not having to somehow mold it into something else. That was the Joan Tollefson piece that we recited. Where the work gets done on its own. We just provide the attention to it. We provide the container where the brew can simmer. Yeah. Yes.
I think you did a wonderful job in trying to capture the fact that our versions, or maybe majority of versions in this room, would be the opposite in some parts of the country, or if we just 10 weeks ago, we could be with groups of people who would find everything that we abhor in the other candidate or in the last administration. And that trying to find a place where, as you said, strongly reacting, but at the same time building bridges, it seems to me that that is exactly right, as at least as a practical thing that needs to be done. Where I get caught is, to come back to the word that Josh used this afternoon, the word privilege. I too don't like it. It could be William Carlos Williams, but I'm pretty sure it's a white male, and a pretty well-educated white male who wrote that. And I was in Milwaukee about 2 months ago and spent some time at a hip-hop center. And those kids would never say, they sure wouldn't say, I too don't like it. Whatever language they were going to use. And their sense was that their whole community was burning down, that their lives were burning down, that everything around them, their futures, everything was burning down. So where I get caught is when I come back to Josh's observation that most people here, certainly I, come from such a privileged position that there are so many buffers that I don't know whether I can find that balance you're talking about for myself, and I don't know if I can find that balance in the face of people who are going to be hurt in a way that I can't imagine, or certainly in a way that I have never experienced. And that's for me, the compassion and the sense, the awareness of privilege throw real wild cards into the whole deck of how, for me, to handle this.
My fallback when I'm quite perplexed about such things, when I'm confronted with someone suffering so great that, from my, as you say, privileged position, it's hard for me to imagine, is just to witness it, just to be there and to listen and to not turn away. There is something in myself that relates to it, maybe not in degree, but in kind, and to meet there. Yeah, that's all I know.
And I think you point to the. I think we should have a certainty in our own blindness, to not think that we have some key or we see the big picture. Our picture, everyone's picture, is so limited, and so the. Kind of to put ourselves in situations that expand it, to know that however deep our insight, we don't see the whole picture, and to have both confidence in stepping forward and humility to realize we know so little, and there are so many different ways out there. And part of our job is to step across the bridge, not say, well, yeah, come over, we'll meet in the middle. No, no. How do we go across and learn what we don't yet know? Thank you.
Thank you. So with those wonderful words of don't turn away and own our blindness, we'll go back to our Zazen practice.